Everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club, technical question and answer next. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net call operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Gene, KY2MY, will be my very new co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for a discussion and to offer our answers as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. Also, we offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange-colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow AMs join our club. By the way, an application is available on our website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try my best to provide an answer, and Gene, KY2MY, will join in. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here or use our email address, tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net tonight, Gene, KY2MY. Good evening, Gene.
Roy, thank you for a warm welcome. This is Joe Yankee 2, Michael Yankee, and I am excited to be co-host tonight.
Well, it's good to have you along, Gene. So, this is the Kings County Radio Club's technical net. Does anyone want to check in with any questions or comments for the technical net tonight? Like they said in that movie Cool Hand Luke, what we have here is a failure to communicate. So once again, if anyone out there has any questions or comments for the technical net tonight, please feel free to push that little push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign, and we'll put you on the list. So, Gene, do you have any questions?
Questions, if I could share my experience with my hotspot.
Would be a great idea, Gene. A lot of people are talking about hotspots. People are buying them, people are using them, people are reading about it and asking a lot of questions. So it's a very hot topic in amateur radio right now. So please, tell us how you're going with that.
To be honest, I haven't completed it working yet, but the build was the most fun part with it. Very simple build, easy to put together, some soldering. That was the easy part. Then I got the SD card. I downloaded the image file, that was not that bad. I put it in the hotspot, and I couldn't figure out why I couldn't get it to work. The next day, I figured out, the hotspot, or the Raspberry Pi Zero, is actually a computer. You need a monitor to see it. Just by plugging into the micro USB, on the computer, doesn't work. So I put a monitor on it, HDMI, and I saw it boot up. It was fantastic. And that's as far as I got so far.
C2GS. Okay, that's very good. It was my understanding, I don't own a hotspot at this point. I've just read some articles. The software, I think, is called PiStar, and I thought you could remotely use a web-based browser. You might have to set up the information locally before you can do it remotely, but is there an option for a web browser on a remote computer that's you know, connected to the network?
Step is to get the Wi-Fi to work, so I'll see the remote. Right now, this is not the Raspberry Pi that has a jack plug in. This is the Raspberry Pi Zero. So I need to get the Wi-Fi working, and then I'll link up with the hotspot to my computer to Wi-Fi.
Very good. Does the Pi Zero have a Ethernet access port as well?
It does not. That's why I need to set up the Wi-Fi to make it work.
Okay, but it has USB connectors, and you can kind of plug in a keyboard so you can type in the information directly?
My point about the keyboard, you need to have what you call an OTG cable that converts your USB female into the USB micro to plug in. I didn't have one at 8 o'clock at night, and I wasn't running out the store to get one, so I took a Q power supply, I cut that apart, got the female adapter, and cut the cable, and I started to get out, made my own cable, and it did work.
Good, very good. I've kind of collected a whole bunch of PS2 to USB adapters, just in case I might need a PS2 connector as well. So you've jumped that hurdle. That's great, and we'll follow your adventures and see how much you like it. I really wish there was a way of interfacing it directly into a computer other than just having a web browser that can set the parameters and such. Because, you know, I'd love to get the audio somehow fed into the computer to just play with it. But my understanding is that it's purely a transceiver-to-internet process. You need either a mobile base station or a handy talkie to kind of jump across, because you need that AMBI chip in it. Otherwise, you won't be able to access any of the digital codec systems.
It's not that hard. You just have to do a lot of research, and it's kind of fun if you have time. I've been busy at work, so I really haven't had so much time after playing with it for tonight.
Very good. It's not a familiar thing, I think, especially for most amateur radio operators who are much happier with knobs and dials and displays that are on the old radios. Computers sometimes make them anxious, but it's nice to pick up new little things. I mean, I don't know if you've played with DMR much, but DMR is a different paradigm as well. You have to understand color codes and zones and all kinds of curious things that Motorola implemented in the design.
I heard someone double. Is there anybody out there wants to break in? No takers. Yes, I had DMR a few years back. I bought one, and it took a while to program. It got to work, but my location is not a good location to hit the repeater, so the handheld DMR didn't work unless I hang out the window, which I got to work on a parrot, and then after that, I gave up.
I mean, I think the number of DMRs in the area have grown, so one of these days, if you have nothing better to do, you might want to check to see if you have a more local DMR repeater. One of the big problems that I found just with the technology involved in DMR is it's a time-based system, so it slices time, which is nice in that you get twice as much functionality out of it. You get two different channels with one single pair of frequencies, as the repeaters only give you one usually, but you get two with time slicing. The problem, though, is that it wreaks havoc with almost every linear amplifier ever made for 2 meters or 70 centimeters. They're not designed to go switching back and forth on the level of 30 milliseconds. So every so often, I used to hear stories of people who plugged in their DMRs to a Mirage brick and just burn out their brick. So that's the problem. And I talked to a lot of people who decided to go least expensive with a handy talkie as opposed to, say, a base station or your mobile type of situation. But the problem is that you kind of lock down to whatever 5-6 watts of a handy talkie. I myself bought the Kinect System CS800, which is a mobile, for about 40-45 watts of output, which I'm happy that I did, because I could use the extra watts. But, well, there's so many different topics and so many things to learn. Let me ask if anyone has come by and is listening to us and has any questions or comments about either what we're talking about or what's on their mind. So please, if anyone out there has any questions tonight, this is AC2GS, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So just give me your call sign and your first name, and I'll put you on the list.
AC2WTA, Joe.
AC2QOP, Gus.
I don't know if you have a question. I would like to hear how things went with the Morse code demonstration.
Okay, Roy. I heard a station come in right after me.
By that, this is KD2QOP. My name is Gus.
Must recognize. Gus, you just joined the club a week or so ago, right?
Guilty as charged, yes.
Welcome aboard. Did you try to check in earlier on the 10-meter net? I think it was this Sunday. Is around 11, give or take a little.
That's what my question is going to be about when it's my turn. Thank you very much.
Okay, very good, Gus. Anyone else want to check in to the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net tonight? Please give me your call sign and your first name.
Kilo Delta 2, Kilo Golf Delta, Tommy, Mill Basin, Brooklyn.
Hey, welcome, Tommy, KD2, KGD. We have you on the list. Anyone else want to put themselves on the list for tonight's technical question and answer session? Okay, Joe, you're first up.
Okay, I was going to ask about the hotspot. We can talk about that later. But as far as the telegraph goes, the event was a big success for the institution. But for me personally, it began as a disaster and then ended up as a triumph. Sunday was very windy and cold, and it disrupted all the activities that I was responsible for. We couldn't do the telegraph. We couldn't do the paint making, because paint making begins with powdered pigment, and powdered pigment doesn't behave very well in 30-mile-an-hour wind gusts. And we had a lot of trouble with blacksmithing. The fire wasn't getting hot enough, and the work was cooling down too fast to be able to work with it. But by about 2:30, I was able to just put the CW key and the computer together with a J38 key, and had a very favorable response. About a dozen people or so over time sat down and tried to tap out their names. So it went very well in the end. KC2, WTA.
Okay, very good. I'm glad that it worked out in the end. J38, almost everyone should have a J38. They made so many of them, World War II, that they're still selling them on eBay. Occasionally you even find one that's in the original box that it came in. So I know I have my own J38, and you have your J38. But, I mean, anyone who really is even vaguely interested in picking up a Morse code and CW and such, they don't go for a lot of money. Some of them are a bit beat up more than others, but it's a nice historic key. It's very functional. It has one of those shorting switches built into it, and it's just a very nice, clean design.
Yeah, in amateur radio, the shorting switch is used for tuning up, but in hardwire or land telegraph, it actually becomes the receive-transmit switch, And I have a very nice example of it. And the setup was very easy. Since it was so cold outside, we set up in a building on a small table. And we didn't use all the mechanical telegraph equipment that we had, the sounders and the relays. And we had two large tents that serve as the headquarters and the field station. And we'd set up two telegraph stations and run the wire between it. It was just too windy and cold to be able to do anything. But in the last, like, 2 hours of the day, we set this up, and people got a kick out of it. So we're going to, we didn't have a chance to film it or take any still photographs, but we're going to try it again on the 4th of July, since Morse code, not the telegraph, but Morse code, is an American invention. We'll try it during the 4th of July celebration, and we'll try to document it. KC2WTA.
Very good, Joe. That sounds like you had fun there. What kind of sounder did you end up using? I assume you used an oscillator instead of the old telegraph systems clacking relay.
We just omitted the old telegraphs and just used the key and the MFJ keyer with a serial connection to a laptop, and had the people try to tap out their names. Some people could do it. I could do Joe a little pretty easy, but Joseph got a little hard. So the people enjoyed it. And so we may, when we do it again, presently we have a military setup, which is just a key, a sounder, and a relay on a lap board. And when we do it on the 4th of July, we're going to use a civilian setup, which is just a key and a sounder in a resonator up on a riser. So, yeah, we had no sounders, just the side tone of the keyer, KC2WTA.
Very good. I don't know if you heard the story. It might be apocryphal. It might not be. But one of the reasons given for the term LID for a bad operator is that back in those telegraphy days, there were guys who just couldn't make out their sounder properly. So they actually took a tin lid of some kind and shoved it next to the sounder to change the quality of the sound that it would emit. And that's supposedly where the idea of calling people who weren't great operators lids came from. My little historical point. Joe, you had a question about hotspots, I believe.
Go on the Sunday morning. Get out of here. I have a cat bothering me. I have a cat who's just crazy about coiled microphone cords. Get out of here. And I heard it a few years ago on the KCRC Sunday morning 10-meter net. But I guess we were interfering with a contest in California, and they were calling us lids. Back to net control.
It's definitely a derisive term. Not 100% sure what it really came from, but the Morse code sounds as good as any other possibility. There's a lot of words that no one's quite sure. Hams is one of the really big words where people get into disagreements of how we got that nickname and such. But yeah, unfortunately, people are given to yell and scream at each other and act out. So Joe, you said that you had a question about hotspots, I believe.
Nothing specific. I just want to know what it is and what it's used for. I was listening. I hear you talking about computer interfacing. So what is hotspot?
Okay. Well, I mean, I think they took the term originally from cell phones. In the old days, cell phones could connect to the Internet, but you couldn't connect a third-party device into your cell phone and then into the Internet, and that's when they started to develop things that they called hotspots as a means to tap into the Internet through a media device. They brought out RF hotspots recently, and a lot of people have been buying them. They're all based on something called PiStar, and what it amounts to is a Raspberry Pi-based microcomputer and a transceiver card module that fits together. What you do is you take a digital mode handy talkie or radio that encodes things into the digital mode. It gets picked up by the hotspot, and once you set the proper settings, it uses your local internet connection to go into the network where that digital technology has a distributed network of communications and comes out some other place. If it's D-Star, it's reflectors. If it's DMR, it's talk groups. And if it's fusion, it's RF. So it's a means, and plus the benefit is that you could, all things being equal, you could use a D-Star handy talkie to get into not only a D-Star group, but a DMR group and a fusion group. Because if you can get to the network on the internet, you can get past the different protocols. You can't use your handy talkie straight up to communicate with another digital type of technology. You can't take a D-Star handy talkie, dial it into a fusion frequency, and expect them to understand anything you say because it's too alien for them. But that's the underlying concept of hotspots. There are Zoom spots, there are RF spots, there's a whole bunch of different versions of the same thing that runs on a piece of software called PiStar.
Control, thanks. We can get on to the other stations. KC2, WTA.
Very good, Joe. This is AC2GS, and next up on the list is Gus. What's your question today, Gus?
KD2QOP. I was trying to get onto the 10-meter net, like you said, and I had trying to set up one of those super antennas. And my question is around the counterpoise. Any suggestions on how best to set that up, whether it should lay flat on the floor or raised up a bit? Again, I appreciate any suggestions on that. KD2QOP.
Sure. By the way, I heard your signal. I was kind of setting my station up at the time, so I couldn't transmit to you. And I kind of called your name a few times during the 10-meter net, so I guess you moved on to another band. Do you have any particular details of is this a ground-based antenna? Is this an elevated antenna? And if so, how high is it elevated?
It's basically a vertical antenna with a coil that's adjustable for different frequencies. It also has a set of ground wires or counterpoise that you kind of string out, attaching to the base and kind of lay it out. And I've been struggling to get it, my SWR below, high twos and such like that. And I was just wondering if you guys have any experience with those kind of antennas.
It's a bottom inductively loaded vertical quarter wave antenna with a counterpoise. So it's shorter than the mechanical resonance would need it to be. So it makes up for it by adding additional inductance from the coil, and you adjust the connection to the coil, giving it the proper amount of inductance so that you're tuning the antenna itself. The counterpoise can be very important because you need a kind of, to a degree, for a quarter wave, you need a balanced give and take. There are ground plane verticals, and those have radial wires going off at right angles in different directions. And the counterpoise is kind of a compromised version of a radial system. The radial should be approximately anywhere from a third, a sixth to, if you can possibly, a quarter of the wavelength of the frequency that you want to transmit on or to tune for. And also, there's a directionality, unfortunately. If you put your counterpoise due north, you're going to tend to pick up better signals in the north than you would, say, on the east or the west. So sometimes people put more than one counterpoise up. There's no requirement that you only have to have one piece of wire. You can have more than one piece of wire. Then it becomes more of a radial than a counterpoise. And you could slope it down if it's convenient for you. You could bunch it up to a degree if that's easy for you. It doesn't really need to make contact with the earth, but if that's mechanically the best, easiest way that you could do it, it should work fine if it's done that way. And you just experiment. But length is very important. If you run a counterpoise that's much, much smaller than a quarter of a wave, it's not going to be quite as effective as it would be if it was something like a quarter of a wavelength.
I'm going to keep on experimenting. I was able, you're right, the directionality kind of threw me today. I was able to move it around a little bit, and I saw an improvement in SWR. But again, I guess part of the hobby is to just play around with it. But thanks for your help. KD2, QOP, over to control.
Welcome, Gus. And please, if you have any other questions or you want to tell us something that you discovered or whatever, just we're here every second and fourth Wednesday of the month. So next on my list, I have KD2, KGD. Tommy.
Good evening, Dr. Roy. I had a problem Monday night, and it was concerning PL136.5 on UHF and VHF on a handheld radio and a mobile I'm using as a base. And I was just wondering if you know what would cause that problem that I just couldn't reach any of the repeaters that run on that night.
Other than the PL type that they were using, was there any other commonality? Were they located roughly in the same area or the same rough distance from you?
No, one was LIMARC, which is 146850, and the other one was on a UHF, which is 441100. They used the same PL tone, and this happened to me about a year ago, and I kind of didn't check, so I used my other radio, and it was doing the same thing. Are you familiar with what could cause that?
This is the first time anyone has found a inherent problem with a particular PL frequency. I know LIMARC has been having a great deal of problems lately. I'm looking at it in the PAN adapter, and it's going from an S6 to an S9 and bouncing around, and it's had some desensing problems, it has crashing problems, it has all kinds of manner of problems. N2ROW seems to be working the same as it usually does. It's a fairly active repeater, as you know. So this is a new one to me. I mean, I'll throw it out to the rest of the audience. But as far as I'm aware, and LIMARC has been using 136.5 for decades, and I don't recall any of them complaining about any problems with interactions. But if anyone else knows anything about why a particular PL tone might be a problem, please hit that push-to-talk button. Okay, Tommy, I'm sorry, but it doesn't seem that generally anyone recalls a reason for that. Now, you said that it's not your particular model radio because you've had two different radios that have demonstrated this odd phenomenon?
Yes, it was Monday evening, and it was on, I have a Yaesu that I use as it's a mobile 100, and I use that as a base station, and then I tried on my handy talkie, and just the PL136.5 on two different frequencies in two totally different locations just weren't, I wasn't able to reach them. And the next day I tried it and everything was fine. And it happened about a year ago. So at first I thought it was the radio because I had just bought it. You know, so this time I tried two of them. And I don't know, it's the strangest thing. And I just want to add that I really enjoy you and Dick on the Sunday night TechNet. It's very, very interesting.
Thank you very much, Tommy. I enjoy the experience and the opportunity to talk with Dick about these things. You know, sometimes it's a little bit too esoteric, perhaps. I don't know, but I have loads of fun, and I'm glad to hear that people are enjoying it. That's the whole point of the exercise. As I say, generally with this lovely hobby of ours, if you're not having fun, you're doing it wrong. So the point is to do things that are fun and hopefully fun for other people. So thanks a lot, Tommy. I appreciate it.
Maybe you can kick it around with other people about this BL tone issue, because it was only on, it was the second time, and it's always 136.5 where that happened. It happened a year later. It was very strange, and I just can't figure it out.
Okay, I'll knock it around with, I know more than a few guys at Limark, and I'll talk to them. It's also within the realm of possibilities. It might not be your case, but N2ROW and Limark have had jamming problems where the control operators have shut it down at times. So it's within the realm of possibilities that you could have happened upon a time when the repeaters were shut down by net control.
Oh, no, they were talking. They were active because every Monday night I always check in because that's my radio club. And people were talking and I just couldn't get there. And that's why I tried that other station because it was the same PL. And I couldn't get through there either. But I tried another different PL and it was working. Other PLs on different, you know, frequencies or repeaters.
This is definitely a mystery. I'll talk to some of the guys who talk on the repeaters. If they have any good ideas, I'll send them a contact technical net here.
Hey, thank you very much, Roy. I really appreciate it. Back to net.
Very good, Tommy. This is the IMAC2GS, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We meet here every second and fourth Wednesday of the month, and we archive these wonderful little things on the website. In an hour or so, it'll be up and available to anyone who wants to hear themselves. So, once again, this is the TechNet, and we do have a TechNet puzzle. It's not that difficult. There's no real trick involved. It says, what would you expect your own meter to read connected to points P and Q? And it's always good to look at the diagram. Basically, you have three resistors. You have a 1-ohm resistor and a 5-ohm resistor in series with each other. And then in parallel to those two in series is an additional 3-ohm resistor. And the choices available for you are 0.9 ohms, 1.8 ohms, 2.0 ohms, and 3.5 ohms. But before we get to the TechNet puzzle, once again, I'll just ask if anyone else has any questions or comments tonight for the Technical Net. Okay, very well. So we'll go straight to the TechNet puzzle. Would anyone like to volunteer what the total resistance of a 5-ohm and a 5-ohm resistor in series and another 3 ohms parallel to those two might read on a volt ohm meter? You sure no one wants to volunteer for this? It's not bad. It's not a trick. It's straightforward, you know, but it it repeats something that you've all learned, but it's always nice to reminisce about technical stuff that you've learned.
I'll give it a try. It's been a while since I used my electrical calculation. I knew if you had a 4-ohm and a 4-ohm in parallel, it would be 2-ohm. If you had them in series, 2 and 2 would be 4-ohm. But when you had a mix, the mix between your mix, I kind of forgot how to do the formula. I did cheat by looking up the formula if you want me to answer that way.
Conceptual way to deal with it is to break it into different questions. If you have a 1-ohm resistor and a 5-ohm resistor and nothing else, what would the resistance, the equivalent resistance be for that combination of 1 and 5-ohm resistors in series?
6-ohm.
Now, the question is reduced to something a little bit easier to deal with. You have a 3-ohm resistor connected to a 6-ohm resistor in parallel. What would that be?
I remember by using they were equal is half, but by having it different, I need to look at the formula, which I did. If you want to answer that way, I really don't want to answer because I knew I looked at the formula.
W2, WTA.
Joe.
Yeah, in this special case with just two legs in the parallel connection, you would use the product over sum equation for this.
Positively, that's how parallel resistances add up. That's how parallel inductances add up. It's not how parallel capacitance adds up. So if you had 3 ohms and 6 ohms parallel to each other, what would the equivalent resistance be?
This is KD2QOP. My guess is 2 using that reciprocal rule, I believe.
Positively, Gus, yes, it would be 2 ohms. The lesson, not only about how parallel and serial resistances get added up, but also that you can break up portions of a circuit into simpler configurations and solve those before you solve the big numbers. So I hope you kind of got a refresh on Ohm's law and how this all works. But you were quite right. The answer was C, 2.0 ohms. Thank you very much, everyone who participated.
C2, WTA.
Joe.
Yeah, the station mentioned that that's the reciprocal rule. Now, the reciprocal rule is used when there's a third leg. In this special situation with two legs, you use the product over the sum method. Once you get a third leg, then you use the reciprocal of the reciprocal method. KC2, WTA.
Okay, I mean, basically what's happening is every resistance that's parallel is 1 over the resistance plus 1 over the resistance of the other parallel plus 1 over the resistance of the other parallel. You add that all up, and then you invert it back, and that's the equivalent resistance of X number of parallel resistors. Hopefully, you know, we don't usually use resistors that much. We pretty much buy our equipment, plug it in, and use it. Antennas, we work hard at, but the resistors, we don't. There are still guys out there who've memorized their color codes, and I never actually memorized them. I always had a little Radio Shack gauge, and I always relied on that.
The color code Z is called Roy G. Biv.
It's the mnemonic to memorize the spectrum of the colors in the rainbow. It's red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. I'm talking about the resistance value color codes. Bands of color are different for different values of resistance on small resistors.
Memorizing the color code. One is kind of immodest, so I won't say it. But the other one is big boys race our young girls, but violet generally wins. And that lines up all the color codes starting from 0 to 9. KC2WTA.
Very good, thank you. I don't know. For some odd reason, I never felt the need to memorize it. Again, maybe I was just kind of handicapped having those freebie Radio Shack charts that they gave away with the batteries and such.
Years ago, Radio Shack used to have the color code as part of the packaging for a package of resistors.
Probably where I first got it, and I just kind of leaned on it, and never really had that much of a problem one way or the other. But you know, I didn't build that many things. Built a bunch, learned how to solder using a wood burning kit that I got my parents to get out of green stamps, and the rest, as they say, is history. Oh, this is AC2GS with King County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone else has any questions or answers or comments or disputations, please feel free to press that little push-to-talk button and say your piece. Okay, give it one last try before we shut things down for the night. If anyone has any closing comments for the Technical Net, please feel free to hit that push-to-talk button. Sense that someone who can't quite get through to the repeater is trying to get through because it's 100% noise. So if you can wiggle the antenna in a different direction or if you actually can turn the power up, that would be great. I'm afraid it's all noise from what I can see, and I can't pick you up on the input frequency as well. You know, better luck next time. Get the antenna a little bit higher, maybe. Height makes might in UHF and VHF. It's height, height, and height of them. Three most important things to think about if you want to get distance in UHF or VHF. That has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be November 7th, sometime after 7:30 p.m. We offer a pre-meeting technical question and answer session, much like this net, from 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock, as time allows. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. The technical net meets on second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m., We have a weekly net featuring Yaesu's Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club repeater, KC2RC. If you can communicate using Fusion Technology, please join in. Members, as well as non-members, are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. Keep in mind, an application is available on our website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website service were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, 3 Alien Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. It's time to roll this all up and shut this all down now, but we'll be back to do it all over again November 14th, and you're all welcome to join us. So I just want to thank all the people that participated tonight, and especially to Gene KY2MY. Without you guys, I'd be talking to myself. This is Roy, AC2GS, clear, and getting the heck out of here. Until next time, guys. Have a good one.